Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize for starting nearly 15 minutes late. And this is Friday, the 29th of April. And you, if you don't want to be in the House Committee on Revenue, you're in the wrong place. And we were scheduled to begin at 1 o'clock, but we have a habit on Friday of just having such a good time. We just get started late.
Sir? I thought we weren't supposed to meet on Friday.
You know what, Representative? If we worked as hard as we worked yesterday, and how hard we're going to work today, we wouldn't have to work except on Thursdays and Fridays. Okay. With that, let's see. I see Representative Richardson in the room. He was just here. Okay. Let's see. Lizbeth, that's the 3087. Why don't you go ahead and let's get started on that.
3087.
Now we had, let's go ahead and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3087.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3087, we've heard this before, but basically you have a dash one amendment which replaces the existing bill, and that's what the proponents of the bill wanted. So the dash one, it creates a tax credit for the value of the volunteer service of specialty physicians and that are performing the medical service for a community-based health center. It defines physician and then volunteer service, and then it specifies that the individuals receiving the health services from the professionals be health benefit plan patients are not covered by health insurance and who have been referred to the physician by a community-based health center. It restricts the physicians eligible for the tax credit to specialists, and they have to be designated then by rule by the Department of Human Services. It limits the physician's hourly wage to $125 per hour for that volunteer service, and then it requires the value of the volunteer service to not to exceed $875. It specifies that the tax credit shall equal the lesser of the taxpayer's volunteer hours and then multiply that by that rate of $125 per hour or $93,750. It limits the tax credit to the tax liability of the taxpayer and cannot be carried forward. It provides a prorated tax credit for non-residents and part-year residents. It requires community-based health centers to apply to the Department of Human Services for certification as health centers for which the volunteer service may be eligible for a tax credit. Then it allows DHS to certify up to 3 health centers. So this was like a pilot project. And so you only have 3 health centers that will be allowed to be certified in 3 geographical areas, Northwest, Southern, and Eastern Oregon. It provides rulemaking authority to DHS to certify those community health centers. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2005 and before January 1st, 2008. So, again, it's for 3 years only, beginning in 2005, 6, 7. Then it limits the period that DHS can certify health centers to before January 1st, 2007. It takes effect 91 days after the end of session. So basically looking at this and establishing just 3 community health centers to attract these specialty physicians to volunteer their time beginning in tax year 2005, I have assumed here in the revenue loss the maximum number of hours, which is 750, which can be certified each year per certified health center, and which will then be claimed in the tax credit. So as you can see from the numbers there, basically I've assumed $225,000 as the revenue loss each year for the 3 years in which they're able to have this pilot project in place. So in the 2005-07 biennium, it's a loss of revenue of $450,000, and the total amount is $675,000.
I have a couple of questions, and I'm sure you've answered these probably before, Elizabeth, but where are the services to be performed? Are they going to be performed in the rural, or is this in the specialist doctor's offices?
Well, Chairman Butler, I think, you know, certainly the physicians have to be willing to have the community-based patients, and so, but I don't think it says here that they actually have to have the service performed in the rural area, they could go to the doctor's office and actually have the service done there.
So we could actually have a neurologist come to Jordan Valley, to the health center in Jordan Valley, if we had a patient that needed that.
Yeah, if they were on contract, that they were willing to volunteer this amount of time in order to do this. So, you know, both, you've got to, first of all, DHS has got to certify those health centers. So there's only going to be three of them.
Right.
And again, in these geographical areas, northwest, southern, and eastern. And then at that point, then they have to monitor how many hours the specialists are going to claim.
Because that's my next question is, who monitors, confirms, and identifies the gratis nature of the service?
Yeah, DHS is really the agency that is, you know, going to be implementing this. So they cannot exceed 750 hours per calendar year for each one of those facilities.
Of the three facilities, the three.
Yeah, each one gets $750,000 each year.
And did the maker of this bill identify any state in which this had happened before?
Chairman Butler, I didn't hear that in the first testimony.
Okay.
Unless somebody else.
This is new to Oregon.
Yes, definitely.
As far
new
as
to
I
Oregon.
Know, it's new. It's a new concept entirely. And it was my understanding in visiting with the maker that he anticipated that most of these services would be gratuitously performed by referral from those clinics.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, it could be in the office, or would likely be in the offices of the specialists away from those communities. So, okay. Questions, further questions of the staff or committee? Or committee staff? Representative Berger.
There is a sunset on this, Elizabeth.
Right. It's a 3-year.
Yeah, 3 years.
It's a 3-year. Is there any accommodation for some sort of measurement of its success other than them coming back and saying how, and this would be fine, how often it was utilized, some way of 3 years or next session saying how are we doing? Mm-hmm. Is there some?
Yeah. Chairman Butler, Representative Berger, no, there's nothing in the bill that specifies they have to complete a report or anything like that, which sometimes is done.
I hesitate to go there because, Mr. Chair, if I may, because it is a small program. You can spend more time evaluating than you ever get to the program. But I would like to put on the record that in supporting this, I would sure like to hear from those health clinics in 2 years as to how frequently this is utilized.
I would guess, Representative, that if you had a health clinic in southern or eastern or Central Oregon that had become somewhat a rural health clinic, qualifying clinic, that had become somewhat used to the fact that they had the ability to reach out to half a dozen very good specialists and that they were getting good results from that, that chances are that you'd probably hear back in a hurry when the program goes away.
And, Mr. Yeah. Chair, I would most like to hear if the decision point was made based on this kind of an encouragement or if they would have showed up anyway if they had been called.
I think that's been one of the concerns that all of us have had. I know that I've heard that expressed. Yeah. Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment that the biggest problem for me is the lack of direction that they would go to the community, because one of the problems out in your area is having to go in somewhere for these referrals, and that's a concern for me.
And Representative Riley, I share that concern because we do have a small clinic with in Jordan Valley, and they have to because that's on Highway 95, which picks up traffic from two different nations besides this one. And the concern that I had was that once people realize that they've got some pretty good specialists that they could refer to out of the Jordan Valley Clinic, and I'm afraid that people from Ontario might be able to go there and start to try and gather those services. But that still said, these are folks that qualify to go to these subsidized, federally qualified clinics too. Further questions of staff? Representative Booker.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion in support of the Dash 1 amendment to House
38-7?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So moved.
Representative Berger, moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3087. Those are dated April 1st, 2005. The discussion? Is there objection to appending the Dash 1 amendments? Hearing and seeing none, we will append the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3087.
Mr. Chair, is this subsequent referred to Ways and Means?
I don't have any subsequent referral.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3087 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the recommendation. Discussion relative to the motion. Representative Lisa?
Well, I'm going to be voting no if we're going to do a roll.
Okay.
No, so, but I don't know how you want to do it.
Further discussion? Let's go ahead and have a roll call.
Representative Beauclerk?
Yes.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Delizio?
No.
Representative Trump?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bergen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hess?
No.
Is that no? Chair Butler?
Butler votes yes. The motion having received the constitutional number of votes on the committee is passed. And we will ask Representative Richardson to carry that House Bill 3087 with the Dash 1 amendment to the House with a due pass recommendation. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3087. Let's see, is Representative Burley here yet? Representative Burley was coming in. I just need to confirm for my records and staff 2950 and 2951. We had those carry over from yesterday.
Chairman Butler, those are the two bills that you passed out yesterday dealing with the dependent care assistance.
Those were both passed out and not on today's.
That's
okay.
Right.
I'm sorry, my staff sent them back down again. And I saw that they didn't have any staff assigned to them. I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And let's see. Okay. All right. House Bill 2776. Mary? And colleagues, I do not intend to hear either House Bills 2338. It's at the bottom of the list. Steve, that's yours, and I told Steve he could go back to his office. Nor do I intend to hear today 3353. That's at the top of the list. Okay, Mary, we will open a work session on House Bill 2776.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2776, we've heard before, it basically eliminates the 2010 sunset provision for historical property special assessment program, which has a 15-year term for each property. We've amended, there had two amendments, two versions. The Dash 1 amendment that I'm presenting to you today was based on suggestions and discussion points that were made during the first public hearing. And those discussion points pertain to whether or not there should be a 15-year local option, whether or not there was benefit to the historical preservation. The background material on this, if for those of you who have not gotten it before, suggests that under current law, qualified historically designated residential and commercial properties are eligible for a 15-year special assessment. This assessment is a property tax that is imposed on the value of the property as of the application date. For tax purposes, the value is frozen for the next 15 years, and assuming the value of property appreciates its value in value over time, it will be less than the maximum assessed values over the same period of time. Subject to meeting qualifying criteria and approval by the State Historical Preservation Officer, commercial properties are currently eligible for an extended property tax special assessment. However, that doesn't exist currently for residential properties. There are currently about 1,100 active historical properties in the program, of which 646 are residential properties. In 2004, The assessed values and exempt values for these residential properties were an estimated $425 million, and the exempt value was $309 million, respectively. The estimated tax loss was about $6.2 million. Enabling owners of a residential property who are currently in the special assessment program to reapply for a second 15-year term will not substantially affect revenues for the 0507 or 0709 biennium because most of them are already in the program and they will not, their assessments will not expire. Okay. Moreover, if these properties are eventually recipients of a second 15-year special assessment, the frozen values of these properties will be reassessed and based on the higher market M50 values as opposed to frozen values that were assigned to these properties during the initial 15-year period. So enabling owners of properties who were previously in the special assessment program to reapply will give you about another 529 residential properties that could come back on the rolls. The amendments to this particular bill, which are included here in the dash one, pertain to the discussion that perhaps it should be a local option and that the second-year, 15-year assessment shouldn't be automatic. So subject to the approval of all local taxing districts within the property, where it's located, the Dash 1 enables owners of historically designated residential properties to reapply for their second 15-year period of assessment. It repeals the special assessment when a property is either sold or transferred unless the new owner assents to the preservation plan in the that's in effect for the property. Okay. The Dash 2, the revenue impacts on this particular bill have not changed at all from what I came up with initially, which is roughly total revenue impact of about $0.48 million in 0507. And the Dash 2 amendment really has a very minor change.
Does the Dash 2 include the Dash 1 amendment? It appears to be inclusive.
No, the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 only differ by one thing, okay?
But I mean include the issues that are, some of the issues that are amended in the Dash 1 are also amended in the Dash 2.
Yes.
So it's either or.
Right, you can only go with either or. The only difference with the Dash 2 is that the second year assessment that has to be approved by all the taxing districts, that's the Dash 1 amendment. That's not quite workable. I mean, it would be difficult to have all the taxing districts in which a property is located get approval. The Dash 2 amendment changes that wording, basically, to the city or to the county in which the property is located.
That's cool. Okay. So rather than taking each of the applications to every district, every taxing district, it's the city or the county decision to freeze the values. Now, it's my understanding, and colleagues, the Dash 2 amendments came after negotiation between the property owners and the city primarily, the cities that came to the table, and it also provides that if the properties are sold, this is not used as a selling tool. The properties which are sold can reapply, but they don't automatically have that historic value relative to the reduced taxation.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
They'd have to reapply, resubmit, and be approved.
Okay. Colleagues, we've got a Dash 1 and a Dash 2. Representative Riley, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And no matter what amendment or if we put an amendment on it or not, this eliminates the sunset completely. Is that correct?
I think it eliminates the sunset date.
Does it eliminate it entirely?
I thought it just extended it.
I think it extended it
for 15 years.
Where does it say that?
That's right.
In the summary, it says it eliminates it. I just couldn't quite figure it out.
Okay.
No.
I think
what it does is it continues to extend the 15-year periods that they have to continue to reapply, representatives, so that every 15 years a property has to reapply. The city and the county can say yes or no at that particular point. So that, in effect, becomes a de facto sunset. Representative Pump?
Because it eliminates the 2010 date, and then it takes the.
Substitutes the de facto. Sunset.
I got it. Thank you.
Further questions relative to either the dash one or the dash two?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2776.
Representative Berger moves the dash two amendments dated 42105 to House Bill 2776. Discussion? Objection. Any objection? Representative?
I want to clear up this removes the state sunset. This would never come before the legislature. And I just want to make sure that's clear.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding. The individual cities and counties, the people who are most affected by this particular issue, then still have the ability to say we don't want these historic districts in our towns. Okay. Any objection to the dash two amendments being appended to House Bill 2776? Hearing and seeing none, we will append the dash two to the bill. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2776-2, amended with the dash two, to the floor for a due pass recommendation.
Discussion on the motion. Okay. The motion is to move House Bill 2776 to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection to doing that? Hearing and seeing none, we'll so order. I will be happy to carry this. I will carry this to House of Representatives, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2776. All right, you're absolutely right. It needs to be. Thank you. Thank you. Your point is very well taken. Representative Burley is here, and imagine you're here too. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2729. Matt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I need to bring it to your attention. Today is the last meeting that we have in April. That leaves a month and a half for the session.
Thank you, Beth.
Where are you going for this month and a half? I thought we'd be home to pick peas.
Okay. Well, just I thought I need to bring it to your attention, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2729, the dash one amendment, I put it in your packets, and also in your packets is a hand-engrossed version of 2729 provided to the committee kindly by Representative Burley. I got this, however, about 12 o'clock or so, and I wasn't able to completely comb through it, but this is the couple things that the dash one does. It basically takes away the ownership segment and the ownership type of arrangement for the entity, which is the Community Forest Authority, and allows or reformulates this authority into a lending agency primarily for non-profits, and those non-profits will be the ones who borrow the money and buy the land. The issue that I was trying to get my mind around after reading this is how is this exactly will work. It's not clear how the bond, the revenue bonds, will be issued against which assets, since the authority has no ability to own these assets anymore. Although in the section 7, page 3, still talks about the assets that would be pledged for these revenue bonds. However, at least for the first set, the first issuance of revenue bond, there is no ability to pledge anything against them yet, because there is no agreements and no land, nothing that there is on hand to pledge. So that might need a really elaborate way of putting agreements between the nonprofit and the authority beforehand in order to pledge whatever comes in time in order to be able to do it. It might need a lot of creative work to do it, because the nonprofit owns the land, but the authority pledges the rents from the land to the nonprofit. So that's a little bit still out there, not clear exactly how it will work. The second issue that you might find also, or I found not able to put my hands or my arms around it completely, is the nonprofit owning the commercial land, which makes it a for-profit, nonprofit kind of thing. and in that sense, it needs to either commit to renting the land to somebody else below market value, therefore they're only getting their cost covered and not drawing any profits out of it, or donating the profits to another nonprofit of somehow, or changing the definition of nonprofit down the line.
But Oregon has a different definition of nonprofit, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's different than the however, it's still by the definition a nonprofit, although it doesn't go through as rigorous as the federal nonprofit 503C.
So at this particular point, Maz, you still have a couple of questions. I see Doug Goh here in the audience, who's legal counsel. Doug, could you address those so that we could get those items cleared up and on the record, please? We are in work session, but we welcome counsel.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Butler, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to address those issues. First of all, and I'm Doug Goh with Rourke Harrington and Sutcliffe at 1125 Northwest Cooch in Portland. And let's take the two issues. First, the issue in terms of what would these revenue bonds be secured by. As we discussed at the public hearing, these are this authority is modeled on hospital authorities. Same sort of analogy. In a hospital authority, the sole repayment source is the nonprofit hospital. The authority has no assets. Same thing here. The nonprofit corporation is the one who the authority loans the proceeds of the bonds to the nonprofit corporation. The nonprofit corporation, then it's their credit. They have to be able to convince the bond market that from the sale of the timber revenues acquired in terms of the commercial forest, that will be sufficient to pay their revenue bonds. Again, this is purely a pass-through finance authority like the hospital authority. Let me also address the nonprofit corporation status. A nonprofit corporation, it's somewhat of a misleading term, because hospitals, in order to stay in business, have to make a profit. Universities like Willamette Universities, to stay in business, have to make a profit. There is no prohibition in the Nonprofit Corporation Act for making a profit. In fact, if hospitals couldn't make a profit, they could not access the capital markets, because what the bond markets require with respect to revenue bonds is not only that you can show that you can repay the principal and interest in the bonds, but in fact that there's going to be a cushion there. We call that a coverage requirement in connection with revenue bonds. The same thing would apply here to the nonprofit corporation organized for the purpose of providing economic development and preserving the commercial forest. It has to be able to show that, in fact, it can operate on a profit basis in order to be able to repay those revenue bonds plus make that cushion or coverage. So really, I realize sometimes the labels may be a little confusing, but in terms of the analogy here, I think it's, in fact, I think it works, and it will be up to the marketplace to determine whether, in fact, that nonprofit, for example, can go to a letter of credit bank to back the bonds and say, yes, here's our forest plan, and we're going to have sufficient revenues over time to repay these bonds back, and therefore the bank will provide the letter of credit to back those bonds, and investors will, in fact, invest in those bonds. Again, this is not mandating anything. This is saying if a city or county decides to create an authority and the authority decides to issue bonds on behalf of this nonprofit corporation, and that nonprofit corporation can demonstrate to the authority, just like a hospital can demonstrate to a hospital authority, that they're going to have sufficient revenues to be able to repay the bonds, then it will go forward. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Doug. Is there an anticipation that the nonprofit would own any other assets before it started then to develop the community forest?
Mr. Tuckman and Representative Burley are here as well, and be happy to address any questions. I think that the way that these bonds are contemplated to be restructured, I think the answer is no. Okay. That in most cases that this will be the debt service on these bonds will be structured overall on a long-term basis, and will be the repayment will be structured in such a way that the forest plan and the cutting of the forest will be cut in a way that over time you'll have a match between the debt service on the bonds and obviously the repayment, and in addition, you'll have that coverage or cushion that I referred to that's necessary with respect to revenue bonds.
Doug, let me just ask this, and I need to get a feel for the numbers, if I could. So what I have is 1,000 acres. Adjacent to the Bend UGB or the Bend area of forest land, and we'd like to see it remain a community forest, and we'd like to see someone set up a community forest authority to come to the market to buy this land. The land for development purposes is worth $1,000 an acre. It's worth $1 million. The worth of the land so far as an operating forest is probably $100-$200. So we have somebody who is willing to come in and develop it for $1,000 an acre and buy it for $1 million and develop it because they think they're going to make more than $1,000 net by the time they're done selling it, including the cost of the time value of money. But the forest authority, the community forest authority, comes in and says, we'll pay the $1 million for it. Willing buyer, willing seller. I don't expect that they would have any donative intent. Maybe they would, which would create another income tax issue too, if there was a donative intent. But we're not dealing with that here, I understand. But so we have a forest that is only able to produce $200, and true value is managed as a community forest by the authority. But now we've got a willing buyer and a willing seller. The authority comes forward with $1 million in bonds. And let's say they're able to structure those bonds at 2%. Really what I'm getting down to is that if I've got folks that are willing to enjoy that forest in 10-acre plots, at $1,000 starting price versus an authority which is able to borrow the money at 2% and see, the folks that are just enjoying that, they're saying, we're putting cash in, we're not caring, it's our home, we're not caring the fact that we've about the fact that we've invested more money into this than what it's really worth as a forest. We're investing in it because it's our home. How's the difference made up in that process? You can't make it up in volume. I mean, it doesn't work out. So how does that happen? What does the community forest authority do to say, fine, we're gonna run these bonds out at 2% and our overhead costs come out at 2.5%, but managed this thing grosses 200, the equivalent of 200, which is just the debt service.
Chair Butler, very, very good question. I would like to invite, since I am not a forester, I'm just a lowly bond lawyer, Mr. Tuckman or Mr. Burley, who have much more a better sense of the forestry aspect of that, to join me. I would say, in response to the question, just from my perspective, is again, this is not, as you say, you have a willing seller and a willing buyer. This is not mandating that. First of all, it won't be the authority who's acquiring the land in the Dash 1 amendments. That's as we promised at the public hearing, the Dash 1 amendments make clear that it would only be the nonprofit corporation who would own the land. It would not be the authority. The authority would purely be the financing vehicle. But let's say the nonprofit corporation is able to make a deal, if you will, with respect to this forest land, then it will be incumbent, obviously, if there are property owners, individual property owners, who can convince that seller who owns the overall property that they're going to make more money than that way, they can still, that seller has absolutely every right to sell to those individual landowners. This just provides a way that if this nonprofit corporation is able to raise the funds through the issuance of revenue bonds for that purpose, that they, in fact, get to acquire that land and keep it in commercial, this big block in commercial forest products. On the other hand, absolutely, the free market otherwise reigns in terms of if the owner, the existing owner of that forest land, can find willing buyers, individual buyers, to development, and they can otherwise figure out all the development, environmental, and land use issues associated with it. You know, either the nonprofit corporation is going to have a higher bid, or the other is going to have a higher bid. And again, in terms of the economics, in terms of the big blocks, I think it would be helpful if Mr. Tuckman, who has a much better sense for in terms of what sort of size of block of forest lands you need to make the economics work.
Thank you. We did hear from Mr. Tuckman and had a handout from him the other day. I guess I'm just concerned that it's a great idea, but the economics of it might not be viable. Representative Berger, you had a question.
Well, I did, Mr. Chair, and I remember this idea from last, and I like the idea, okay, but I'm still, because it's sort of this new animal that I liked your explanation about the university or the hospital, but if you walked up to me and said, what's that university for, I'd say to provide a liberal arts education.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's that hospital, I'd say to provide health services for the community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you walked up to me and said, what's the purpose of this, what would be your answer?
Chair Butler, Representative Berger, as I understand the purpose of this from a policy standpoint, it's addressing the issues that Mr. Shelk from Rochco Lumber raised the other day, and that is within Oregon, in certain areas, we only have certain amounts of large blocks of forest land left that can remain in commercial forest. And this is a vehicle, a financing vehicle. Again, it doesn't mandate anything, but it does give the opportunity that if a nonprofit corporation can come in, obtain the financing, convince a bank that in terms of the economics do work, and therefore acquire that land, that in fact that way that land, instead of being broken up into these lots to sell to individuals, can remain in the commercial forest.
So if I could paraphrase, but just a bond lawyer,
yes,
it is to preserve large blocks of commercial forest land in Oregon.
Yes.
That's for the benefit of... If I could continue,
sure,
because
please.
I mean, the municipality that originally financed this or whatever, if it goes into this nonprofit, they can't take it out. It kind of becomes its own animal. Do you understand what I mean? The way I understand what you're constructing here, it becomes its own animal that, I mean, the university reinvests in more education. Are they going to reinvest in more forest or better forest practices? The hospital reinvests in more. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at here? This is a new animal. I'm trying to figure out what it looks like.
And Representative Burley, thank you for coming forward to help us through. You're a professional forester. We've got our bond counsel here. We've stumped him.
I think this is an important question because we're creating something here that I'm...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and thank you very much. And you're absolutely right. This is a very important question. I don't know if Mr. Shelk shared this with you the other day. This is just an example of what we're looking at. This is a 30-plus thousand acre, and by the way, this whole concept, this bill, would not work on tracts of 1,000 or even 5,000. We're talking about the large contiguous blocks. This is what's known as the Bull Springs Tree Farm, formerly owned by Crown Pacific, now in the hands of its creditors, specifically an insurance company and a large finance company. And this is, in fact, you can just barely see down here the red line. This is the western extent of the UGB of Bend. So you can see how close this is to town. Some of these tracts have already been sold off, I think 180s or 240s. I'm not sure exactly what they can do. 240s. For home sites, for a home site. The green is all federal land, both Forest Service and BLM. Of course, Sisters is just up in this area. This is very key winter range for mule deer throughout here. Crown Pacific has always been, in my opinion, very generous when they own this property and the fact that they always allowed public access up there. There's roads that go up onto the Forest Service. There's signed and maintained mountain bike trails that go across the ownerships. So most people, I would suspect, that go up there don't know when they're on private land or when they're on public land. To me, personally, I would just as soon see this stay as a large block of working forest, providing those values, the habitat, the water quality, the air quality, and the timber revenue. And any excess timber revenue after expenses are paid, debt service is paid, any applicable taxes are paid, stays with the county or whoever set this up. So if there are excess revenues generated, they come back to the county, local ownership, local control, and they go into schools or roads or whatever's set up when this whole thing's set up. So that's what the public value is both the ecological aspects of it as well as the economic aspects of it.
One more follow-up.
Please.
The question then for our can this nonprofit take its profit and turn it back over to the authority? Or the municipal authority. I mean, what's the mechanism there? If it's I mean, could Willamette say?
Wouldn't it negotiate it in property tax?
Would it be in that? In that? Is there a mechanism for that? Assuming there is profit, which is another whole question that I haven't asked yet, and I won't, because I've dominated too long. But
Chair Butler, Representative Berger, if I understand, the question is, could the nonprofit corporation plow its profits, if you will, back over to the authority? Again, remember that it's the nonprofit corporation, it's going to own the forest land, not the authority. The authority is just the financing mechanism. So the contemplation is that under the terms of the articles of incorporation of that nonprofit, its purpose is to keep that forest land in forest land. And so that, in fact, just like Willamette, whatever profit it makes, it puts back into improvements of the university, this nonprofit would put those back into preserving habitat and preserving a healthy forest. So, in fact, that it's not just a one-time, you know, you cut the forest, but you cut the forest and you reforest. And I think that's the whole idea here, is that you're setting up a structure that the purposes of this nonprofit corporation is to keep these commercial forest lands in commercial forest lands, reinvest in those lands. So in terms of the, I think that's at least as I understand the purpose of the bill. And again, as I also understand the bill, that the nonprofit, in terms of the property taxes, will go to the continue to go into the local community. I hope that addressed
that helps
the question.
Yes, Matt.
The question that I was trying to get my mind around, and I called the council before, is after the bonds are paid and the nonprofit owns the land and starts drawing revenue from the land, do we need to change anything in statutes or definitions in the nonprofit in order to make those revenues go to another nonprofit? Or because that conceivably is a large amount of money that paid a ton of debt. So what needs to be changed in order to maintain this nonprofit type of?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I don't believe that there is anything that needs to be changed in terms of, again, I think, you know, as we often do, when we first drafted this bill, we tried to put a lot of flexibility in it, in the bill. And so initially it was drafted so both the authority could own, in which case, in terms of, as well as the nonprofit could own the forest land. There were some concerns from various members of the legislature about the authority owning the land. And so we have tried to address those issues in the Dash 1 amendments. And so in terms of, whereas there may be some kind of lingering things in the bill, I don't think so. But I think that, in fact, the way it's set up now is just like when a hospital pays off its bonds that a hospital authority has issued, that nonprofit corporation continues its life as a nonprofit corporation and as a hospital. Nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And here, because there is no remaining ownership in the hospital authority, or in this case, the community forest authority, there's no need to really do anything after, once the bonds are paid off. They're paid off in the community authority. But the whole idea is that nonprofit corporation continues to keep that large blocks of forest land for habitat, commercial forest lands, for the policy issues that Representative Burley addressed. Does that address the question?
Thank you, Doug. We have Legislative Council Connie Harrison here. Connie, can you come forward, please, and give us an update on the concerns that we're addressing here?
Thank you. Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel, for the record. You know, I certainly don't usually try to volunteer to run down here to the hearings, but Mr. Mollick and I had talked earlier, and some of the questions that this gentleman, I didn't catch your name, sir, but this gentleman answered in largely the same way that I would have. I would have talked about the coverage requirements. So there is clearly a requirement that, I mean, there is nothing that requires a nonprofit corporation to be hand-to-mouth. They certainly can, in fact, make profit. And your questions, Representative Berger, I think were sort of on target with what I just tried to get asked by Mr. Mallett, that what is the purpose of this entity? It's to preserve blocks of forest land. At some point, the revenues required for the bonding, though, would go away. And so I did wonder, is there a point at which we would have so much profit that there would be more than is required to maintain the forest lands, to renew the forest lands, to improve the forest lands in some way. But I should also say that I thought the analogy to a hostile corporation, hostile authority, was a very good one. And that is essentially, I think, what we're creating here is an entity that would be for the management and maintenance of that forest block. There's no requirement that it be a hand-to-mouth organization. It should have some money in the bank, both to support the bonds that would be issued, and ultimately to support its purpose of maintaining the lands. But I wanted to sort of get in there because I had wondered if I had had to answer the question, I would have said, well, perhaps at some point in the future we would have to need to redirect some amount of monies to some other nonprofit purpose. It's not necessarily so, as the hospital example shows. I mean, there's no requirement that they be hand-to-mouth. They do, in fact, have money in the bank, but it's used for continuing that purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Conley. Representative Berger, follow up.
I don't want to dominate here, Mr. Chair, but I really like this idea, and I really, so I'd like to explore while I've got these people one more aspect of this. Is there anything in this authority that would prevent them, if they're losing money, from selling off this valuable land the way it's constructed? Or, I mean, are they restricted in their authority from the get-go in the management of it because of this purpose of preservation? Do you understand? I mean, we've been talking about the upside, and that's great. There's always the downside, and sort of what does that look like in this proposal, in the statutory language?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Berger, I thank you very much for that question, because that's exactly why we made some of the amendments that we did in this dash one. First of all, just at the risk of sounding like I'm overly sensitive, I want to say that this is not for preserving these lands, because that has the connotation that we're not going to manage.
Preserving them as forest land.
Right. Well, it's not that we're preserving them, i.e. not managing them. What we're trying to do is maintain the integrity of these large blocks of land and keep them in a working forest condition to provide all of these values, both environmental and economic. I'd also like to call your attention to, on page 6 of this hand engrossed for the dash 1, Section 14 talks directly to the question that the earnings of a community forest authority created here that are in excess of the amount required for the retirement of indebtedness shall not inure to the benefit of a person or body other than the municipality creating the authority. So, what appeals to me about this so much is that if we can structure these things and address the issues that the chair brought up about the economics, these have the potential of creating revenue for the municipality long term. I want to emphasize that long term, but nevertheless, that's what these lands are for, and that's what we're trying to do.
And Representative Burley, changes in the leadership of the municipality, then they, at that particular point, as times change and the population and people change, then it's assumed that they could conserve these lands, preserve them in different methods than perhaps the earlier folks.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that's exactly why on page 1 of the dash 1 amendments, when those same questions had come up before, we added in there to be very, very, very clear that the purpose of this is for the the management of commercial forest land used to produce the revenue, et cetera, et cetera.
Excellent. Okay. My method of producing revenue in an accounting office was different than someone else's, and my concern was that, you know, things change, but it's still within that definition. It's still going to be forest land, and it's still going to be used as a working forest ultimately. Let me just ask this question again. Getting back, you've got 240 acres being sold adjacent to the UGB, and to assume that there's about 100 of those 240 acre parcels out there. How much did the 240 acres sell for?
Last thing I heard, one of them was going for about $1.2
million. Okay, so for $1.2 million times 100, you get, let's say, $125 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's not inconceivable that somebody could come in and buy that for $125 million. Do you anticipate that that your local authority would be able to borrow that amount on a low interest as opposed to someone coming in and saying, listen, we think we can make these properties worth 10 times that much by making a special Sun River Dude Ranch.
Well, and Mr. Chair, in fact, the one parcel that one of the more recent transactions in Central Oregon was a nearly 40,000 acre block up outside of Sisters, just east of the Metolius Basin, that was owned by an industrial timberland owner, and they sold it to a private individual who then went to the county and asked for a destination resort overlay. There's clearly a higher and better value on these things, and the question is how close to that can you get with good, sound, sustainable management of the forest land. And these numbers are all going to vary depending upon the piece of property you're looking at and its location. Because if we're looking at doing this with, you know, some of the former Boise Cascade lands in Malala County, the numbers are going to be different than the Bold Springs Tree Farm in Deschutes County. But, you know, the idea is you're going to want to get as close to that as you can with good sustainable management of your forest land. And then the difference there, you'd have to figure out how you're going to finance that.
I please don't misunderstand. I still like the idea. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great community project. And, you know, if your Lions Club or Rotary Club or Sir Optimus had the cash to do it, they'd probably be out helping with it, too. The Odd Fellows. Thanks for bringing that up. But I guess the concern that I've got is that, you know, no matter how altruistic our motives are, my concern is that private industry might be able to outpay you 3 or 4 to 1. And my real concern is that no matter how good the prior owners of this particular plot of land are, or may have been, it's now in the hands of the receivers, and they may really, really, really like this to be operating as a tree farm, but when they're looking at it and saying, do we take this $300 million offer, or do we come back to the authority and give it for $125? And I'm just concerned that this may have gotten ahead of us, and it, as Representative Berger says, it's been around for the idea's been around. Let's see, we had Representative Esquivel had a question.
Mr. Chair, may I first address that?
You bet.
Because this bill it doesn't mandate anybody to do anything.
Oh no, I appreciate that.
And just because I'm, you know, Bull Springs Tree Farm to me is a really good example of what we're trying to do. I mean, you know, the numbers on it may never, ever work out, and if it doesn't, it doesn't.
No, I appreciate that.
And there's certainly no intent on my part to get in the way of any private transaction. I would just assume that property be owned by a private timberland. But, if you know, this is just another option that we're trying to get in the toolbox.
Representative Vestal.
Now, Doug, we've worked in the past together. Is this the same setup where the local municipality or the county has to give blessings on this, even though it's a separate bonding body?
Chair Butler, Representative Esquivel, yes, Representative. To the extent that these are issued on a tax-exempt basis, since the members of the hospital or the, pardon me, the Community Forest Authority, my apologies, are appointed, not elected, members under the federal tax law. The creating municipality would also have to approve the issuance of the bonds.
So the commissioners for the council would be voting yea on it.
That's correct. That's correct. So you have kind of another layer there.
Representative Boquist, have a question?
Actually, I have more than a line of questioning, Mr. Chair.
You got a line of questions?
Yeah, towards you.
Okay.
I want to go back, Mr. Chair, because several points that have been brought up. And I guess for the record, I am a member of the Small Women's Association. I own timber, so I'm maybe slightly further. I am north of you in the timbered land, purchasing out in the flat plains of Ontario, Mr. Chair. But
the treeless flat plains.
The treeless flat plains. Exactly right. In the case, I mean, you brought up a good example. You have 1,000 acres. First off, is anything on the far side of the Cascades, there's a 99.9% chance you cannot carve that up into less than 240 acres, period. Yep. So you would not have 10 or 100. You only have four buyers to be potential. If you then convinced the Planning Commission under a matrix of things this thick, which is why Measure 37 passed, that you could carve it up into four chunks. So when you start dividing the economics up to this thing, you start finding out if someone thought they could spend $300 million, they would have done it already. Because as we sit today, there are hundreds of thousands of acres for sale in this state right now in chunks in excess of 40,000 acres that are being sold, that are going wanting, frankly. Mm. And in the northern end, a good example of trying to prevent this in Willamette County, which is why Willamette County Commissioner was over here, and at least I'm testified in one portion, is that if a good example of a 5,000 acre tract just north, 13 and a half miles north of Enterprise. That tract, no disrespect to my good colleague over from Medford, but in the end, instead of being timberland, exactly what you said transpired. Three realtors went together and purchased this piece of property. Now, I happen to know from 10 years ago somebody did the same thing and they ended up losing their shirt on it because they could not subdivide it and get it out there. So when you start looking at the economics of timberland, just north of that 5,000 acre tract remains to be the partial that was raised up before. It's a 28,000 acre piece of property that is owned formerly by Boise Cascade and Doug Timming. What's the name of the new company?
Oh,
it's similar. Right. Capital Forest. It's
right. I can't remember the exact name. Mm-hmm.
And that particular tract, they're forced wanting to sell and get rid of it, which is why one of the interests is, you know, Willamette County is, you know, interested in it. But the economics of it, because of land use planning, is not as far-fetched as one would think out there. And so when you look at this from an opportunity to invest in it, from a public perspective, you have the oversight from the county. And then you have the ability to go in and actually purchase the land at a value that is sustainable as a forest. I see this, again, like they do, as another tool that's in there, because we're seeing these things spin out of control. And what we're also seeing that needs to be on the record is we have seen, whether we have done it or not, we've seen one step farther where we've seen timber companies that we could have used this mechanism to purchase but have gone to the public officials and tried to convince them to buy it, which would take it off the tax roll and take it out of production, would eliminate jobs. And I happen to have lost, just for the record, I mean, we just lost a rail line in the southern part of my district yesterday. And because of the lack of timberland, that mill down there and the lack of that rail line that we lost yesterday is probably going to be unsustainable. And we're going to lose another mill when, in fact, if we had looked at the option of this years ago, we may have the timberland standard to sustain that mill. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Yes, just a quick comment, if I may. First of all, I appreciate Representative Berger's line of questioning, because I came into this, I write down what I think I'm going to do. I had a big question mark on this one. And what you did, even though you said you were dominating, got me through this, and I appreciate that. And my point of view at this point is I like this, as you do, and whether or not they're able to actually buy any land, I believe we need to give them the opportunity to try.
Thank you. Representative Riley is moving the dash one amendments. Is there further discussion on the dash one amendments? Hearing and seeing none, is there objection to the dash one amendments? Hearing and seeing no objection, so ordered. Representative Riley now moves House Bill 2729 for the dash one amendments to the House to do fast recommendation.
Thank you.
I'm not voting for it.
Okay. Any other objections? Be it noted for the record that Representative Comp is a no vote. Of the rest of the committee is present.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Who moved it? Who moved it? Representative Riley moved the dash one, and Representative Riley moved the dash one, or the amended bill to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you. And the record indicates, let the record read, that the committee is has one no vote, Representative Comp, and the balance of the committee is all present with aye votes. With that, we will move House Bill 2729 as A amended to the House bill, to the House floor, the do pass recommendation. Representative Burley, will you carry that to the House floor?
Be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
We will close the work session on House Bill 2729 and excuse the members. Thank you very much for attending today.
Thank you.